Urshna, Sufis, the People of the Path, Volume 2, Talks on Sufism, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 9.
Bhagwan, there was once a Sufi who wanted to make sure that his disciples would, after his death, find the right teacher of the way for them. He therefore, after the obligatory bequests laid down by law, left his disciples 17 camels with this order: "You will divide the camels among the three of you in the following proportions. The oldest shall have half, the middle in age 1/3, and the youngest shall have 1/9. As soon as he was dead and the will was read, the disciples were at first amazed at such an inefficient disposition of their master's assets. Some said, 'Let us own the camels communally.' Others sought advice and then said, 'We have been told to make the nearest possible division.' Others were told by a judge to sell the camels and divide the money. And yet others held that the will was null and void, because its provisions could not be executed. Then they fell to thinking that there might be some hidden wisdom in the master's bequest. So they made inquiries as to who could solve the insoluble problems. Everyone they tried failed, until they arrived at the door of the son-in-law of the prophet, Hazrat Ali. He said, 'This is your solution. I will add one camel to the number. Out of the 18 camels, you will give half, 9 camels, to the oldest disciple. The second will have a third of the total, which is 6 camels. The last disciple may have 1/9, which is 2 camels. That makes 17. One, my camel, is left over to be returned to me.' This is how the disciples found the teacher for them."
Sufism depends absolutely on the concept of the master. Without the master, there is no Sufism. Sufism does not believe in the books. It believes in the living master. One has to come to somebody who has come to know by himself. The books may contain great wisdom, but there is no way to decode it. If you decode it, you will decode it according to your mind. That will falsify the book. Islam is known as the religion of the book, the Quran. Hinduism also is known as the religion of the book, the Veda. And so is the case with Christianity. The word Bible simply means the book. But Sufism insists that the book cannot help you. No book can help you. Sufis have, of course, a book they call the Book of the Books, but it is empty. Nothing is written in it. Not even a single word. That is their attitude about the books. That although many things will be there, but for you it will remain empty. Because you can read only that which you know. Just the other day I heard somebody ask Mullah Nasruddin, "Why did Jesus say, 'Blessed are the poor in spirit'? Mullah thought for a while and then said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for they have no money to buy booze." Another time, and somebody had asked Mullah Nasruddin, "And what is the 11th commandment?" And he said, "Thou shalt not get caught." Your mind will become your master when you are reading a book. And the mind is the problem. This mind can continue perfectly well with a book. The book is dead. The mind has to interpret, comment, decide what is the meaning. So when you are reading a book, you are reading your own mind in an indirect way. The book goes on throwing you back to yourself. You may become very learned, but you will never become a man who really knows. You will know many things about God, but you will never know God. And you will know many things about truth, but you will never know truth. And to know about is just meaningless. To know is the thing, not to know about. To know about means you have missed. But the books can give you a very, very strong feeling that you know. Without knowing at all, you can come to the field that you know, and that will become your greatest barrier in knowing. That will become a China wall around you. Your bridges will be broken. How to bridge? How to connect? How to attain to this connectivity with the divine? The divine seems so far away. The divine seems almost impossible. The God is not obvious. The God is not close by. You look all around and the existence seems to be almost empty of God. That's what Martin Heidegger says, that I have not found a single thing in the world which I can call sacred. From the ordinary standpoint, he is right. Where you can find the sacred? The sacred is missing. Not because the sacred is not there, but because you don't know how to feel the sacred. You don't have that intuitive capacity yet evolved that can feel the sacred. God is far away. The world is too close by. Matter is all around, and you never come across the spirit. Hence, religion remains just a theory. It never becomes an experience. Sufism believes that you can approach God only through a master. A master is one who can become a via media, who will be just between you and the divine, a door through whom you can have a glimpse. He knows not as knowledge but as experience. His experience has transformed him, transfigured him, transported him to another world. A master lives in two realities together. A master is a paradox. His one feet is in the world, his another feet is in God. From one side he is just like you, and from another side he is just the opposite of you. A master is a paradox. Through the paradox of the master you will be able to reach the divine. There is no other way. So the first step for a seeker is to fall in love with a master, to seek a master. If you can find a master, half the journey is over. And in fact, the most arduous part is over. To find the master is the basic requirement of becoming a Sufi. Sufi seekers travel for thousands of miles in search of a master, in search of the man with whom they can feel in tune, with whom they can vibrate into the unknown, with whom they can take the first step beyond the known. So the first thing, the first and the most important thing is to find a master. Sufis say the greatest blessing of life is to be with a master. If you are not with a master, you have missed the whole opportunity. Then you lived with the non-essentials. Then you never came in contact with the essentials. And the only way to come in contact with the essential is to be connected with someone who is in contact. It is almost like, have you seen somebody in a circus or in a carnival or in an exhibition sitting on an electric chair? The chair looks ordinary. You can't see that the chair is electric chair, vibrating with electricity. And you can't see, because it is not visible to the eyes, that the man's whole body is electrified. But if you touch the man, you get a shock. The man who is sitting on the electric chair is electrified. You cannot see, but if you touch, you are immediately connected with electricity. And so is the case with a master. He is electrified by the divine. It may not be visible to those who are just spectators. It may become an experience only for those who come close and touch. Once you have touched a master, or the master has touched you, something that has never been in your consciousness has happened. And from that knowing, there is no way to fall back. It is irreversible. And once you have felt it, then you know it is. And then you can see in the trees, and in the rivers, and in the people, the same flame. Maybe not so clear, clouded, hidden behind smoke, asleep, but it is the same, whether asleep or awake, hidden behind a cloud of smoke or with no smoke, burning bright, it is the same flame. Once you have touched a master or you have been touched by a master, Michelangelo has painted the day of creation. In the Sistine Chapel, he changed the whole story, the biblical story, and even people who were making the Sistine Chapel, who were financing it, and the Pope, even they could not detect that something he has done utterly new, which is not in the Bible. The Bible says, God created Adam He created Adam by mud, humus, hence the word human. And then he breathed into the nostrils of Adam, he breathed life. Now Michelangelo must have thought, I was looking in his diaries, there are many references, he thought for many days, to paint this will look a little awkward, God breathing into the nostrils of Adam. It will look a little awkward to paint it. So he changed. He has painted one of his most famous paintings. God is touching Adam, not breathing. Just God's finger is there from the unknown. God is high from the heaven in clouds. Adam is on the earth. Just the finger comes and touches Adam. And that touch makes him alive. Nobody has thought that he has changed the whole story. It is not so in the Bible. Not by touch, but by breathing into Adam. Adam was made alive. But Michelangelo was a student of Sufism. He was deeply interested in Sufism. And he must have come across the idea, the touch of the master. That the disciple becomes alive by the touch of the master. Yes, it is a touch. It is a flame from one lamp into another lamp. A jump of the flame. Once you have felt it, and it is a feeling, there is no way of describing it. Once you have felt it, you have become aware of the sacred. Then it is all over. Then only it is. So Sufis say the greatest blessing of life is to find a master. One who knows, one who sees, one who is. You are only when you are in God. Before that, you are just empty. Before that, you are a house without a master. Before that, you are just a dwelling where nobody dwells. Before that, you only think that you are, but you are not. You are very momentary. You are bubble-like. You don't have any integrity. You don't have any center. You don't have any souls. Gurdjieff, who was immensely impressed by Sufi ideas, in fact, who was a Sufi master, has introduced a very new concept into the Western mind. In fact, nobody has talked about it that way before. Gurdjieff introduced the idea that you have no souls. The soul has to be created. Don't remain placid, smug, and don't remain confident that you have the souls. All the great religions have told you that you have the souls. It is already there. But Gurdjieff introduced a very new insight. He said the soul is not there. There is only a possibility of it. You can have it, you may miss it. There is no certainty about it. You have to create it. Yes, if you want, you can create it. But don't take it for granted. Don't think that it is already there inside you. This is a Sufi insight. Sufis say, only the master is, you are not. One who has seen God exists for the first time. You exist only when you confront God. You exist only when God looks into your eyes and you look into his eyes. you exist only when you are touched by a God, and you touch God. Before that, your existence was just an emptiness, a dark night of the soul. It was just a stumbling, a hoping, a waiting. It was very insubstantial. It was dream stuff. It had no reality in it. A master is one who is really there. He has presence. He has a kind of radiance. And you can find it. And you can observe. Sometimes just sit near a hotel and watch people. Or by the side of the road and just watch people passing by. And start looking for one thing. Can you make a distinction that few people walk like empty cells? And there are many. They are the majority. But sometimes you come across a person who has a kind of presence. You can observe that he is surrounded by an aura. You can feel that he has magnetism. You may have observed sometimes unknowingly that you were sitting few friends and then comes a person and suddenly the whole company becomes alive, as if the coming of this new man infuses you with life. Just a moment before, all was dull. You were sad. You were just dragging, talking rubbish. One has to talk. You were passing time. Then enters a man or a woman, and suddenly there is a radiance. Everything flares up. Everything heightens. Everything is turned on. Nobody is off. A man of presence has entered. It rarely happens because men of presence are rare. It is very rare to find two men of presence in one company. It is very rare. But whenever a man of presence is there, it is loud and clear. If you are even a little bit alert, you can see the quality. The empty man exhausts you. If you are sitting by the side of the empty man, he is a parasite. His emptiness pulls your energy into himself, and there it disappears. He is like a black hole. Physicists say there are black holes in space. If anything comes into the area of the black hole, it will be simply sucked in, and it will disappear out of existence. A black hole is a star which has collapsed into itself. And a star is a big thing. This earth is very small. The sun is 60,000 times bigger than the earth. And our sun is a very, very mediocre star. Million times bigger suns are there, which are stars. When a star collapses, dies, everything has to die. Whatsoever is born has to die. When a star dies, it collapses into itself, towards its center. It has great gravitation. Because of the gravitation, everything is sucked in. And it creates a great negative atmosphere around itself. And whosoever comes close by will be sucked in. Einstein has said, even sunlight, even sun rays, coming closer, will not be able to get back. Now, ordinarily, it is very difficult to keep the sunlight caught. It reflects back. But from a black hole, it will not reflect back. It will simply be caught and disappear. Anything that comes too close to the black hole will simply go out of existence. A man who is empty is a small black hole. That's why you feel sometimes very much tired by meeting a certain person. You avoid. Even to say hello to him on the road is tiring. Just by passing him and he takes something of you, a lump of energy disappears. You are poorer just by saying hello to that man or seeing that man. He is an empty, negative space. Whosoever comes by, he sucks. These people are tiring people, exhausting people, parasitical. Just the opposite is the case when a man has prajnas. When a man has prajnas, he is sovereign energy. He has too much. He is overflowing with energy. Whenever you come close to such a man, you are blessed. Suddenly you feel the shower. You are close by a waterfall. You feel cool. You feel tranquil. You feel vital. You feel a kind of power and also a kind of poetry arising in you. Altogether, you would like to be with this man again and again. Just to be in the vicinity of this man is life enhancing. The man of prajnas spreads all around his energy. He is reaching people and he has something to give. He is a giver. He is an emperor. That's why in the East we have called sannyasins Swami. Swami means a master who has to give, who is not a beggar. The person who is empty and he has no soul yet is a beggar. He is constantly begging. He is a begging bowl. He will take something from you. You will always feel it if you go into a crowd and you have any understanding about your life and the way energy functions. You will always feel that you come home a little less than you had gone. A chunk of your being has been taken by the crowds. The crowds are always tiring, exhausting. Because in crowds you will not find the man of prajnas. Only people who are absent. Only people who are sleepy. Only people who are empty. The master is a man of prajnas. He has an utter authenticity. A substantial being, he has soul. This soul has to be created. You are just a dwelling. You have to provoke the guest to come. You have to invite the guest to come. The house is ready, but the guest has not come yet. Sufis say that how you are going to learn the ways of being present unless you are in the presence of a man who is present. That's what a master is. A master is not a teacher. A master is a magnetic force, a magnetic field. of positive energy, of presence. Sufis say, whenever you come to the master, you have barakah, you have grace. That is the meaning of Hindu satsanga, being in the presence of the master, to receive his grace. He is giving. And you are not obliged when you receive his grace. Because even if you were not there, he was going to give. Even nobody was there, he was going to give. That is just natural, as rivers flow. As a flower opens and the fragrance is released, so is the natural thing with a master. He has bloomed. The fragrances are released to the winds. Whether somebody will receive or not, that is not the point. If somebody can receive, he will be blessed. If nobody receives, then too, the master will go on showering. He does not shower especially for you. He cannot help. He has to shower. Just as from a lamp, light goes on showering, and from a flower, the fragrance, so is the case with a master. Sufis are right. They say a master is one who knows, one who sees, and one who is. That thing has to be remembered, one who is. To come in the presence of one who is the first step on the path. Before that, all is futile. Before that, all is frustrating. The fulfillment starts only when you have become connected with one who is fulfilled. And this relationship between a master and a disciple is a love affair. It is not a rational thing. It is more of the feeling than of the thinking. So those who think too much may go on missing. Those who feel, only they can connect. Remember, this shift has to happen. From the thinking, you have to go to the feeling. Feeling is closer. Closer of something in you that is called intuition. Thinking is the farthest point from intuition. Thinking is a kind of tuition. You have been taught by others. That is tuition. Something that has not been taught to you and blooms in you, that is intuition. Nobody has taught you. No school, no university, no college. Nobody has said anything about you. It explodes in you, that is intuition. You need not go anywhere. You only need to go inside yourself. Feeling is closer to intuition. I don't expect the impossible. I don't suggest be intuitive, that you cannot do. Just now, if you can do one thing, moving from thinking to feeling will be enough. Then from feeling to intuition, it is very easy. But from thinking to intuition, it is very difficult. They don't meet. They are polarities. Feeling is just in the middle. From the feeling, thinking and intuition are at the same distance. If you go this way, you reach thinking. If you go that way, you reach intuition. In feeling, both meet and merge. Something in thinking remains in feeling. Of thinking remains in feeling. And something of intuition too. Then you can choose. To find a master means to have a change into your mind. You have to become more feeling. If you go to a master with all kinds of thoughts, those thoughts will not allow you. Those thoughts will not function as bridges. They function as walls. People are so alone because they don't create bridges. They create walls. And then they suffer. And the walls are created by you. When you are searching for a master, remember, you have to change from thinking to feeling. When you come to a man where you can feel presence, even if you are too much caught up in your thinking, the presence will be felt. It is such a vital thing, you will feel the presence. But then you have to allow it. And you have to slip more and more into the feeling space. So more and more you can be in contact with the presence that is there. Once the contact starts happening, then it takes you on the greatest journey of your life, the greatest adventure, the greatest ecstasy. The first step, Sufis say, is to come in the presence of one who is present. Before that, all is frustration. Before that, there is no life. Only after that, there is life. Life starts only when you are connected with a master. Before that, it was only a dream, a mirage. Before that, it was only thoughts and thoughts and thoughts, a desert land. Only feelings bloom. Thoughts never bloom. Thoughts are very unproductive, uncreative, because they are borrowed and they are never original. Not a single reality can be created by thoughts. And not a single reality can be discovered by thought. Thought is very important. All that is known is by feeling, all that is discovered is by feeling, and all that is created is by feeling. The second step is surrender. And then there are no more steps. The whole path is covered just by two simple steps. One is coming in contact with someone who is in contact with God, and the second is to surrender to Him. Two simple steps, Sufis say, are enough. In two steps, the journey of millions of miles is finished. The first is the most arduous. Once you have come in the presence, by and by, you will start surrendering. You cannot resist long. The real thing is to come in contact. Sometimes it happens, you don't come in contact and you surrender. Then your surrender is false. Then your surrender is from the mind. Then your surrender is just pseudo. Then you are pretending that you have surrendered. But you have not surrendered. It is just a strategy. You want to exploit the man of presence. There is no way to exploit. You want to gain something. You think, okay, if surrender is the condition, I will surrender. But your surrender cannot be surrendered. Surrender has to happen. You cannot do it. You cannot will it. If you will it, you can take it back. If you do it, you can undo it. Surrender is a happening. So go step by step. And there are only two steps. First, be suffused with the presence of a master. Be drunk. and then a surrender comes on its own. You start feeling you are bowing down. Don't be in a hurry. Sometimes it happens. You do things in a hurry. Particularly in this age, hurry is one of the problems. Everybody is in a hurry, wants to do everything fast and soon. So if you come to some master and you hear that surrender is needed, you are ready to surrender. You say, why not? Let us see. If something happens, good. If nothing happens, there is nothing to lose. But this surrender won't help. This is not the surrender Sufis are talking about. That's why they say it is the second step, not the first. The first is to be in the presence of the master. Now there is a sannyasin, Praghos. He goes on writing to me again and again that, why, Bhagwan, you look very ordinary to me. I have not answered him yet, but now the right moment has come to answer. I don't look ordinary, I am ordinary. But what is his problem? I am not worried my ordinariness. I am immensely happy with it. So why Praghos will be in trouble? His trouble is, he wants me to be very, very extraordinary, a man of miracles or something. Some nonsense is in his mind. He wants me to be stupid, that I should produce S or Swiss watches or do some miracles. He is in search of a magician, not of a master. And this search is of the ego. Now he wants me to be very extraordinary, so his ego can feel very good that he is surrendered to an extraordinary man. If by my touch I cure people, and by my touch I make dead people alive, then Praghos will be very happy. This is the man to surrender to. But then you will not be surrendering to me. It will be your ego trip. You will feel very good and satisfied that you are the disciple of such an extraordinary man. Sufis don't believe in miracles. They think they are stupid. And only stupid people are attracted towards miracles. A master is ordinary. A master is a normal man, a regular. A master is so ordinary that he has no kind of ego in him. All extraordinariness is a kind of ego. A master is simply nobody. His ordinariness is a nobodiness. Only people who suffer from inferiority seek extraordinariness. If one has come home, there is no search for extraordinariness. There is no search for speciality. To be ordinary is so extraordinarily beautiful. But I can understand his troubles. He wants to have an ego trip through me. So he is disturbed. Bhagwan is not doing any kind of miracles. He is a sannyasin, but what kind of surrender is this? This is not surrender. He has not even come into my presence yet. He has not yet got what I call that connectivity. He has not been touched by me, and he has not touched me yet. And he is a sannyasin. He must have been in a hurry. He should have waited a little. Just the other day, his woman had come. Urmi is his woman. And she was crying. And she was saying, what to do, Bhagwan? Prabhos puts me on such a high pedestal. He thinks almost of me as if I am a goddess. And then he makes me feel guilty because I am a human being. He expects me to be a goddess. And if I don't behave like a goddess, then he makes me feel guilty. While she was relating her misery and story, I was thinking, so he is doing that to you too. That's what he wants to do with me and to me. He wants to put me on a high pedestal, a miracle man, or something extraordinary that doesn't happen. Once he has put me on a high pedestal, he will be in control. Then he will be powerful over me, because he will have the control. If he wants to put me down the pedestal, it is his pedestal. That's what he is doing to his woman too. First he puts her on a high pedestal and then tortures her. He becomes powerful. How the ego goes on playing tricks, you have to watch. Now, on the surface it looks just the opposite, that he is such a humble man. And he puts his woman on such a high place that she is a goddess. You will think he is very humble. He is not. He is very tricky. He is being very political. And he may not be consciously doing it. It may be just his unconscious ego trip. Once you have put the woman as a goddess, you are powerful. Then she cannot be human. Then you can find faults with her. And then she will be afraid of you. Afraid because any time you can put her down. That's what he wants with me too. First he wants me to put on a high pedestal, then he becomes powerful. Now see the game. Even the disciple wants to become powerful over the master. If I am ordinary, then he is no more powerful. Then he cannot put me anywhere lower than I am. I am just on the plain ground. Where he can put me down, then he has no power. Otherwise he can come and say, Bhagwan, you are so high, don't do this, don't say that I have been watching. For these 20 years, I have come in contact with millions of people. And this has been one of my observations, that everybody wants to control the masters. People come to me and they say, you should not say this. Because that will bring your image low. You should not say this. Just an Indian came few days before and he was saying that you should not talk about homosexuality even if somebody has asked a question. And even if it is not wrong, you should not say so. Because otherwise people think you are in support of homosexuality. This will tarnish your image, he was saying. People have been suggesting me all kinds of things in these 20 years. You should not do this, you should not say this. I used to stay in Jaina families. They will tell me you should not eat in the night. Because if you eat in the night and somebody comes to know, they will think what kind of saint you are. Now, if I want to be on their pedestal, I have to be hungry. I stayed in one ashram, Vinoba's ashram. and I get up at 6, and the Nova get up at 3. So his disciples came to me and they said, what are you doing? You should get up at 3. Otherwise people in this ashram will think, what kind of saint you are? Because we have become accustomed of seeing the saint getting up at 3. I said, you don't think about me that I am a saint, but I am going to sleep up to 6. Your thinking about me is of no value. I am not going to disturb my sleep just for being your saint. Forget about it. You should not do this, you should not be that, you should not say that, you should not comment on this. So many advisors, and they all think they love me. And they all think they are followers, disciples. They are just helping their masters to have a good public image. And they go on saying that we don't say that you are wrong, we are just saying because public image. Now this Prabhus wants me to put on a high pedestal, then he becomes powerful. Then if I want to remain on the high pedestal, I have to look for Prabhus. Where is Prabhus? Otherwise I will not be on that high pedestal. Who will put me on that high? Remember Prabhus, expecting me to be extraordinary is just your ego. You want to be a disciple of an extraordinary man. Your ego will feel very, very enhanced, fulfilled. I am ordinary. And I am absolutely ordinary. I don't look like ordinary. That is again a trick. He is asking me, why you look so ordinary? Not that he is saying that you are ordinary. He cannot believe that I am ordinary. Maybe I am just pretending to be ordinary. Then there is some hope for him. Someday or other, I will show my extraordinary miracles. Prabhus, you are hoping against hope. It is not going to happen. I am simply ordinary. It is not that I am pretending or playing game of being ordinary. I am ordinary. And because I am ordinary, there is a possibility for you to surrender. And I am not going to do anything that can give you any notion about me that I am extraordinary. I am not going to do anything. Only then your surrender will be true. If you can surrender to an ordinary man, ego will disappear. Sufis have never done miracles. Sufis have always been very, very ordinary people. That is one of the basic of Sufism. Because the master exists to help you surrender. And he can help you to surrender only when he is nobody. If he is somebody, then to be connected with him, you will feel somebody. You will feel good that you are no ordinary person. You are connected to an extraordinary person. You are extraordinary. Connected to a nobody. That's what surrender is. And through surrender, you will come to see that the ordinary life is so full of beauty and benediction. These trees are ordinary, and these birds are ordinary, and this sky is ordinary, and this earth is ordinary, and God is ordinary. Because there is no ego. So, who bothers to be extraordinary? Existence is ordinary. But this ordinariness is so beautiful. It is a beatitude. And to be ordinary is to be religious. those who are here with me and are really connected with me will know what I am talking about. Why this hankering for extraordinary? There must be some kind of inferiority complex in Praghos. So he is seeking some superior being. If he cannot be the superior, at least he can be the follower of a superior being. But it is an urge coming out of an inferiority complex. In surrender, you surrender all. Your inferiority complex, your superiority complex, your ego, your humbleness, you surrender all. A surrender has to be total. You put yourself in a bundle and you throw in the feet of the master, you say, I disappear from this moment. And from that moment, there is no question. How there can be questions on that moment? Then you don't question the master. It is finished. Question before you surrender as much as you want to question. But once you have surrendered, then there is no need. And if still questioning continues, if you are still suspicious and doubtful, then the surrender has not happened. The first step is to come in contact with the master, and the second is surrender. And Sufis say the whole journey is complete. How to find a master? Not by thought, of course. By thinking, you go on keeping yourself in the same rut, in the same old rut and the past. By thinking, you remain old. You stop all possibilities of being new. And watch, you are constantly thinking. There is a constant chattering inside, the internal talk. Even while you are listening to me, just a second, look in, and the chattering continues. There is a constant internal talk. This internal talk divides you from reality. Once this internal talk disappears, even for a few moments, you are one. One with reality. One with the master. One with the beloved. One with God. Wherever you want to be one with your woman, with your man, with your master, with your God, with the existence, whenever you want to be one with something, in a unison, this internal talk has to disappear. That's the only barrier. Without dropping internal talk, you cannot find a master. The question arises in many people's mind, how to find a master? You will have to learn ways how to be silent. And when you come in the presence of somebody who is present, sit silently. Collect yourself together. Calm down. Don't think, because thinking is an activity. Just be. It will be difficult. But if you try, then few moments, it will happen. Those will be very, very small moments, just intervals. They come and they go, but even in that interval, flash-like, something will descend on you. You will be connected, disconnected, connected, disconnected, but it will happen. And once, even for a single moment, you have touched somebody who is, you will know the taste of it. Even a drop of it will give you the taste of it. And then all taste starts disappearing. Then that taste becomes your only taste. Then all desires start converging into one desire. How to be with this man and how to be totally with him. And every day it goes on growing. One day, suddenly you find you are surrendered. Yes, you find one day you are surrendered. It takes you unaware. You were not planning to surrender. It has happened. Internal talk is the way of the old self, is the way to remain hung up with the past, is the way to remain in the ego. And you are constantly thinking day in, day out. It is always there like an undercurrent. Once it is broken and you fall into the world of intuition. Intuition is hiding just there behind this layer of internal talk. So learn how to be without internal talk. That is the way to find a master. And it will be easier for you to learn sitting by the side of the sea. Looking at the roaring waves, there is nothing much to think. You can just go on looking. Lying down on the grass, looking at the sky. In the night at the stars. Watching the trees. There is nothing much to think. There is no need to think about the stars. They are there, so beautifully there. You can just be with them. Learn first to be with nature. Because nature is silent. It does not respond. It knows no language. So you will be able to fall below the level of internal talk. And then start searching. Then start looking for people who have presence. And when you will come around a person who has presence, you will suddenly see you are infused with energy. You are vibrating with a new rhythm. A dance has entered you. Each cell and fiber of your being is pulsating. You are very close by of something immense, something incredible. It is said of Buddha, the day he became enlightened, he started feeling few hours before that day that something immense is just by the corner. It was driving him crazy. He could not figure it out, what it is. But something is there around the corner. Something is going to happen. That urgency became very, very penetrating. At the last moment, just few hours before he became enlightened, it was almost like a pregnant woman. The 9 months are over. And any moment it is going to happen, the child is going to happen. But the pregnant woman knows. She has a visible symptom that the child is there, kicking. inside her belly. But when you are going to be reborn into Buddhahood, into Satori, Samadhi, nothing is visible. And something is kicking in the belly. And he was sitting underneath the tree where he became enlightened, and a woman offered some sweets in a bowl. He ate the sweets, went to the river to wash the bowls, and it was coming, and it was everywhere, and he could feel it. It became so urgent that Buddha has never done anything like this that he did that day. He puts the bowl in the river and he says to no one in particular, but to existence itself, that if something is going to happen, give me some indication. Don't drive me crazy. Buddha does not believe in any God, so he cannot address God. He is not talking to anybody in particular, he is simply saying to existence, are talking to himself. Give me a visible indication. Let this be the indication. If this bowl starts flowing upstream, then I will be satisfied something is going to happen and it is too heavy on me. And the story is beautiful. The story says, the bowl started floating upstream. And within seconds, it disappeared upstream. This is just a parable. But then Buddha was satisfied. Then he rested underneath the tree. Yes, it is going to happen. And by the morning it has happened. This is just a parable. Don't take it literally. Don't think that really the bowl started floating upstream. It simply says that to be connected with God is such an absurd phenomenon, as if a bowl starts floating upstream. It is against all so-called laws, against the law of gravitation. It is against the all so-called laws that we are aware of. It is a new phenomenon. It is a new law functioning. Things are upside down. What has never happened before is going to happen. Always the consciousness was empty, now it is going to be fulfilled. Always the consciousness was going outward, now the consciousness is going inwards. That is the meaning of the bowl floating upstream. Always the consciousness was going low, downwards, now it is rising high, upwards. That is the meaning of the bowl floating upstream. A new law penetrates. To be connected with the Master is the beginning of a new world, a new universe. For that you will have to sacrifice the old. And to sacrifice the old, nothing else is needed, just the internal talk has to be sacrificed. That keeps you a captive in the old reality. That is the world that has to be dropped. That is the world that has to be renounced. And that's what surrender is. When you have seen something new, which you have never seen before, when you have felt the presence of a man who is a man of God, then this is what is needed. You surrender your internal talk. You bow down. In the East, this has been symbolic. The disciple puts his head in the feet of the Master. That is just symbolic. It has nothing to do with your physical head. It is simply symbolic. The head is the symbol of thinking, of mind. The disciple puts the mind into the master's feet and he said, "Now you take care." And the master takes care. In fact, when you surrender to a master, you have nothing to surrender. Never think for a single moment that you have done something great. In fact, the master has been really compassionate that he accepted you, because now his will be the responsibility. And that is the meaning of this story. There was once a Sufi who wanted to make sure that his disciples would, after his death, find the right teacher of the way for them. Not only while he is alive, he will help you. The master will even provide provisions when he is gone. He will make arrangements, because those who have trusted in him, they should not be left in the middle. This Sufi master is just on his deathbed. Few have arrived. Few have reached. Many are still struggling. Now remember that many disciples of this master must have arrived. Why they can't function as teachers? To know is one thing. But to help others to know it is quite another. Every enlightened person is not a master. And every teacher is not enlightened. There are people who are good teachers, great teachers. They can teach beautifully, very articulate people, with immense capacity to teach or make things clear. But they may not have known themselves. Then all that they are trying to teach is borrowed and dead. There are people who may have known, but are not capable of teaching. Because teaching has nothing to do with just knowing. For example, you may have seen a beautiful sunrise. That does not mean that you can paint it. That you come home and you paint for your children and show them that this is the beautiful morning that I have seen. And it is possible, somebody who has not seen that beautiful morning, you describe it to him, and if he is a painter, he can paint it without seeing it. And his painting will be better than your painting. Your painting will be nothing. It will not give any idea what you have seen or what you are talking about. The same is the case in the inner journey. There are teachers who have heard, but are articulate people. And there are masters who have known, but are not articulate. The rare phenomenon is when a master is a teacher too. When an enlightened person is articulate too. He has known it, and he has the ability, the art, to help others know it. This Sufi was dying. There must have been few of his disciples who have become enlightened, but they are not teachers. And he must have been worried. What is going to happen to those who are in the middle? The master must provide. He must find a way so that they can find a master. Now, Sufis work in very, very strange ways. But they know how to work. He could have told. that go to Hazrat Ali. Hazrat Ali is the son-in-law of Muhammad. Go to Ali. He could have said it is so easy. It was so easy. But that would have been not right. He wants them to find themselves. Because when you find something, it has immense value. When somebody says, and you do it, it is no more so valuable. Then you are doing your duty. The master was dying and he said, when I am dead, you go to Hazrat Ali. So you follow the old man. You say, we will have to go to Hazrat Ali. You may like Hazrat Ali, you may not like Hazrat Ali. It will be a kind of obligation, a duty. That will miss the whole point. The master wants you to seek the master. The master wants you to grope in the dark. So when you have found, you have the feeling that you have found. This is one of the most important things to remember. Those people who had found Muhammad were immensely profited. But now there are Muhammadans, millions of Muhammadans. They have not found Muhammad themselves. Their fathers have told them. That has not been their own search. Now they are just so-so. Lukewarm Muhammadans, as there are lukewarm Christians. The first disciples who had searched Jesus and found him were thrilled. They have really found something on their own. Their whole life was transformed. But now your father says, Christ is the Savior. Christ saves. He is the salvation. You go to Christ and he takes you to the church. You go reluctantly. Because nobody likes anybody's truth. And that is a basic arrangement in life. It is built in that nobody likes anybody's truth because anybody else's truth is a lie to you. So the master could have said it was easier. Ali was there in the same place. And he was a well-known man. One of the rarest followers of Muhammad. Of great insight. He could have said that I am dying. Now, it will be difficult for you to walk on the path that you were following with me, you go to Ali. He will help. But that would have missed the basic thing in it. The master has to be found. You have to risk. You have to search. You have to surrender. It would have been too secure. From the old man you would have heard, you would have said, okay, so when you are dead, we will go to Ali. It would have been simple, but of no help. So the old Sufi created a device, a very strange one. He therefore, after the obligatory bequest laid down by Allah, left his disciples 17 camels with this order. He must have been a wandering dervish. With camels, he must have been wandering all over the country with his disciples. He leaves 17 camels with the order, you will divide the camels among the three of you in the following proportions. The oldest shall have half, the middle in age 1/3, and the youngest shall have 1/9. Now very strange and absurd, illogical. But masters are illogical. They are not much worried about logic. He used it as a device. It is something that cannot be done mathematically. As soon as he was dead and the will was read, the disciples were at first amazed at such an inefficient disposition of their master's assets. They were amazed. They must have become a little doubtful, because what kind of arrangement he has made? 17 camels, half to be given. So one camel will have to be cut. Then one third have to be given. So few camels will have to be murdered. How can you divide alive animals in this way? This is so absurd. The idea must have come to him. Had the man gone senile or mad? He was so old, maybe he has lost all ideas how to figure things out. This was so absurd, so blatantly absurd. Doubt must have arisen. They must have been puzzled. That was the device. The master wanted them to puzzle. Now, watch. You will be surprised. You may not have understood that point. Before you can choose another master, the old master has to be lost. Otherwise, how can you choose a new master? The old man has made a perfect device. It is so absurd that they will laugh that this old man was finished, and it is better that he is dead and we are free. It is good now to search somewhere else. If this man had been alive, still we would have been clinging to him. And he has gone mad. The master has condemned himself so that they don't go on hanging with the past master and his memory. So the past is closed. The chapter is finished. They can start a new chapter in their life. Some said, let us own the camels communally. Now the logic enters. Now they started thinking what to do. The order cannot be fulfilled as it is. We will have to find a way. Now interpretations, thinking enters in. The order was simple, absurd. Now somebody suggests, let us own the camels communally. They are trying to find out a way out. Others sought advice and then said, we have been told to make the nearest possible division. So somebody, a wise man, a knowledgeable man, must have suggested that it is simple, make the nearest possible division. Don't be foolish. You are not to cut the camels. Just the nearest possible, the approximate will be right. And remember, Sufis don't believe in approximate truth. And they are very exact people. They mean what they say. And they say what they mean. Now, first the disciples themselves thought that it is better we should own them communally. That was the closest to own communally. They went to ask somebody, now things will start going farther and farther away from the master's intention. Some said, make the nearest possible division. Others were told by a judge to sell the camels and divide the money. Now things have become very, very worldly wise. This is perfectly okay. Why bother? You can divide the money, sell the camels. And yet others held that the will was null and void because the provisions could not be executed. This is the farthest. They said it is not possible. You drop the whole idea. the will is null and void because it cannot be done in the first place. Now, so many interpretations. The disciples started thinking. When a master gives you an order, it is not to be thought over. It has to be listened. It has to be meditated, not contemplated. Otherwise, you will miss the message. You have to meditate over it. You have to keep it in your womb. You have to sleep over it. You have to keep it there inside you and wait. Just wait. Keep it inside. Remember it and wait. Don't start interpreting. Your interpretations are your interpretations and are going to be meaningless. Not only meaningless, they can be harmful. A man, jailed for 20 years, kept his sanity by befriending an ant that used to share his cells. He even made a two-story home for him in a matchbox. To while away the hours, the convict made a tiny guitar, and in 5 years he taught the ant to sing and play the guitar. In the long winter evenings, the ant was of great consolation, giving recitals and concerts for his benefactors. In another 5 years, the convict had taught the ant to dance, and by his 12th year, he was also an accomplished ullian pipe player. As the day of his release approached, the convict began to realize that he had in his possession the greatest television performer ever known. He would be rich, famous. On the day of their release, the ex-convict rushed to the nearest pub to celebrate his liberty. He ordered a pinch, and while he drank it, he produced the matchbox. Shoved the ant onto the counter of the deserted bar and asked for a tune. The ant rose to the occasion with a lovely rendition of The Heart Bowed Down. He was powerful. His owner, so overcome with joy, calls over the barman and knocks towards the ant. "What do you think of that?" says he. Whereupon the barman raises his hand, brings it down on the counter and kills the ant. "Sorry about that, sir," says he. "It is the heart better." Now the barman has his own interpretation. He has not looked in this end. It must have been an everyday thing. Somebody will call a customer and he will say, "Look, the end on the table." And he will kill it. And he will say, "It is the hot weather." Now he has killed one of the most precious ends. And that's what happens when you bring your interpretations in. The master has left a great device behind him, through which the disciples are going to find their new master. But the interpretations will kill the end. All things that have been suggested to them are against the will. And nobody has even an inkling of the idea what the master really meant. An old Irish Catholic lady was lying on her deathbed. The priest was called to issue the last rites. The priest took her hand and said, "Now, Mary, you know where you are going, don't you?" "Yes, Father," she said. "And you have been good all your life, not sinned, said your prayers every day, and been a pious woman?" "Ah, yes, Father, I have always been a good Catholic," said Mary. "Then I have a question to ask you, Mary. Before you go to meet St. Peter, are you ready to answer, Mary?" said Father Patrick. "Ah, yes, Father, ask me anything." "Well, Mary, what I want to know is, Do you want a white lining to your coffin or a purple lining? What is the difference, Father? Said Mary. Well, said the Father, if you have really been a good woman, not lusted, committed adultery, never stolen, envied, been greedy, or used the name of the Lord in vain, and been a good Catholic, you shall have a white lining to your coffin. But if you have been a sinner, lusted, committed adultery, been greedy, vain, envious, stolen, or used the Lord's name in vain, and been a bad Catholic, you will have to have a purple lining to your coffin. Now what I want to know is, what color be wanting in your coffin? Mary closed her eyes, thought for a moment and said, well, Father, I would like a white lining with a little dash of purple here and there. Your interpretations are going to be reflections of your mind. Whatsoever you say reflects you. So when a master gives you a device, you are not to think about it. Otherwise you will miss it. Thinking is the sure way to miss it. You have to meditate upon it. And meditation does not mean thinking. It simply means keeping it in your awareness. Just keeping it there. Not forgetting it, that's all. Sitting silently, keeping it there, not forgetting it, that's all. Not doing anything positively about it, just letting it be there. And sooner or later, something will open inside you and you will have a vision. And that vision will be the meaning of the device. Your internal talk will have to disappear to know the meaning. If your internal talk continues, and not only that, disciples not only thought themselves, they went to ask other people. Now that was foolish. What a judge has to do with it? It is not a legal matter. In fact, it is not a will. The master is not concerned with the camels and how they are to be divided. How a master can be concerned with such non-essential things? Then they went to a liar. Now wow, a liar is concerned with it. It has nothing to do with the law. It has nothing to do with this ordinary world. They must have gone to wise people, so-called wise. Wise in the ways of the world. Clever, cunning, calculating. And they suggested all these things. But they were fortunate that they didn't get involved into any interpretation. Then they fell to thinking that there might be some hidden wisdom in the master's bequest. So they made inquiries as to who could solve insoluble problems. Then they came upon one thing, stumbled upon one thing, that the problem seems to be insoluble. Whatsoever solutions have been given don't seem to be pertinent, adequate. No solution seems to be perfectly fitting the situation. And the problem seems to be insoluble. More insoluble it became as they collected advices from people. So now one idea arose in their consciousness. They should seek somebody who can solve insoluble problems. That's what Zen people call koan, an insoluble problem. It can be solved, but it is not solved by logic and reasoning. It is solved by intuitive energy. It is solved by silence, not by words, not by figures. It is solved by utter silence. Now they are coming closer to the point. So they started looking for the man who could solve insoluble problems. Now Sufis are known to solve insoluble problems. In fact, all great problems are insoluble. Because life is a mystery. It cannot be solved. And Sufis are interested in the mystery, not in solving it. All religious people, all religious search is concerned with the insolubles. First they went to the magistrate, the lawyers, the mayors, and people like that. Then they became aware that the problem seems to be insoluble and no solution seems to be adequate. We must go to somebody who is interested in insoluble problems, in the mystery of life. Everyone that tried fails until they arrived at the door of the son-in-law of the Prophet Hazrat Ali. He said, "This is your solution. I will add one camel to the numbers. Out of the 18 camels, you will give half, 9 camels to the oldest disciples. The second shall have a third of the total, which is 6 camels. The last disciple may have 1/9, which is 2 camels. That makes 17. One, my camel is left over to be returned to me." Now, Sufis say, your problems cannot be solved as they are, unless the master adds something of his being into you. That is the meaning of the whole story. 17 camels are there. You are in a puzzle. You are those 17 camels. Now there is no way to solve, unless you come to a man of compassion, who is not only ready to solve your problem, but is ready to be involved in you. That is the meaning. The story is tremendously beautiful. Now they had gone to many people, but nobody has thought that one camel can be added, and once the camel are 18, things become simple. They become divisible. The master is one who is ready to get involved with you. When you surrender to a master, he opens all his doors to you. He is available to you. He becomes involved with you. You are committed to him. He is committed to you. You surrender nothing. You don't have anything to surrender. You surrender only that which you don't have. And the master starts giving you that which he has. Now these people had come with a problem. The problem in itself was insoluble. But Hazrat Ali solved it. And the device is, he added one of his camels into their camels. So the first thing to be remembered, a master is one who can give his being to you, who can become associated with you, who can come to you and hold your hands, who can make your problem his problem, who does not think from the outside as a spectator, who becomes a participant. When you come with your problems to me, never think for a single moment that I am standing there like a wise man, aloof, away, and advising you. Not for a single moment. I get involved with you. I become you. I stand in your shoes. Your problem becomes my problem. Only then I can be of any help. Unless I become you, I cannot help you. Unless I become you, I cannot even understand you, what to say about help. Unless your problem starts becoming my problem, unless I am surrounded in your problem, there is no way to solve it. That is the difference between a therapist and a master. A therapist sends outside. He brings his expertise, his knowledge to help you. A master, he does not bring any expertise, he has none. He does not bring any knowledge to help you, he has none. He brings his being, he brings his knowing. He gives you his eyes, he lends you his eyes, not his knowledge. He lends you his vision, his clarity, his transparency. He becomes you for a moment. And those who have loved me will understand it. While talking to them, I become so involved with their problem that they are almost an observer. It becomes my problem. And whenever it becomes the problem of the master, help arises. That's why the disciples' utter surrender is needed, so that the master can come and have a deep meeting with your being. This is your solution. I will aid one camel to the number. Out of the 18 camels, you will give half, 9 camels to the oldest disciple. The second shall have a third of the total, which is 6 camels. The last disciple may have 1/9, which is 2 camels. That makes 70. And then comes the last beautiful thing. One, my camel is left over to be returned to me. Because whatsoever the master gives to you, always goes back to him. You are transformed in between masters coming to you and going back. But whatsoever is given goes back to the masters, because in the very nature of things, it cannot be given. It can be only loaned at the most. It is his being. How can he give it to you? The being cannot be given. He can only loan it to you for a moment. But even in that single moment, things become clear. And then whatsoever is master's goes back to him. This is one of the most beautiful parables Sufis have invented. First the master gives to the disciples. Disciples' problems are solved. Then whatsoever is given comes back to him. The master gives you his being, transforms you through it, you become luminous, and he does not lose anything, because whatsoever is his comes back to him. That's why the master can go on giving to millions and nothing is lost. Now many times questions come from you that, Bhagwan, now you have so many disciples, so many sannyasins in thousands. It will be difficult for you to help us. Not at all. Because it is not something that can be divided. I can give my vision to as many people as are ready to take it and receive it. And yet it remains intact. It always comes back to me. You cannot take it away. Numbers don't matter. One or 1 million, it makes no difference. Remember this. Only one who is ready to get involved with you can solve your life problems. Outsiders cannot solve it. The master has to become your inside. And remember that sooner or later, when you have arrived home and your light is lit and your flame is burning bright, don't be a miser, remember. You will not be losing anything. You can go on giving to as many people as you want. You will not lose anything. It is not possible to lose. That which is yours, you cannot lose. Only that which is not yours can be lost. Money can be lost, stolen, divided. Naturally, if a father has four sons, then four sons will divide the money. If he has 16, then 16 will divide the money. And more sons he has, poorer will be the sons. But not so with a master. A master can have 1,000,000 disciples or 10,000,000 disciples. It does not make any difference. It does not make the disciples poor, remember. Because the master can go on giving to everybody. Nothing is lost. So when you become masters in your own right, you will become one day. Then don't be a miser. Share it. The more you share, the more you become beloved to God. Enough for today.